Blog Talk Radio.
Carol the Coach, sex, love, and relationships. We talk about it here.
Carol the Coach, compassion with contemporary relevance.
I am a psychotherapist. I can be your personal life coach, and I can help you with your issues. There are no problems too small or too big. You can talk about anything.
Speaker, columnist, radio TV host, and commentator. Carol the Coach brings messages of wellness and empowerment within reach of everyday people every day.
Almost 5 years ago, I lost my soulmate in an accident. He was killed in a plane crash. Life just for me has seemed to stop.
There are groups all over the city. I mean, I teach one. It is a specific way to start thinking so that you shift how you see the world, which then shifts your energy, and then you feel better and you actually see things differently.
Carol the Coach, always available to at carolthecoach.com.
Now I've got Russell on the line.
I'm 47 years old. I'm a truck driver. I'm married. I have a wife in San Francisco.
Okay.
I haven't been home in 6 months. My thing is, I don't know if I have a sex addiction or what the problem is. Why do I want what I can't have? And as soon as I can have it, I don't want it anymore.
You're right on target when you say, I don't know if I have a sexual addiction. Well, guess what? Yes, you do. And you know what? That's my specialty, Russell. So you're at the right place. Continue.
I meet women online, and I'm in a different part of the country. I travel all 48 states, so I love sex.
I hear self-esteem issues. You never felt good enough, and you didn't feel like you were getting what you should have then, and you're reenacting that now. Do you want to change that about yourself? I got an interesting email this week. He says, thank you for taking my email in question. My girlfriend and I listen to you on the radio, and she respects your opinion as I do. So here's the question. I've been separated for 9 months. I'm working on a divorce. Is it okay to date? I believe it is. But she's not comfortable with being around people who know my divorce is not final. Can you help? He kind of answered it.
He did. He kind of answered it when he said she is not comfortable with it. Hey, life is all about boundaries. And especially if you're dealing with sex addiction as the addict or if you're the partner of a sex addict. You need to figure out what are your boundaries so that you respect it. And if you're needing a good book on boundaries, McLeod has probably the Bible on boundaries. His last name is MC, C-L-O-U-D. And then I just received a book the other day called The Boundaries Book, 20 Uncommon Tips for Reducing Conflict, Developing Healthier Relationships, and Enjoying Life More. And it is by Patrick A. Means, and he's author of Men's Secret Wars. Obviously, you can tell he knows about addiction. So those are the two books that I would recommend on boundaries. You just can't get enough information on boundaries, and here's why. When you practice boundaries and you do it in a thoughtful and a respectful way, you're using self-respect. That's right. You're able to very clearly understand and put out what you need, want, how you feel, and the direction that you want to go. So I cannot give you advice to study what boundaries are all about. Hi, I'm Carol the Coach. And if you have a question for me, you know it is always okay to email me at carolthecoach@aol.com because this is a show to help you to become a better person. And I don't know, I've got about a 50-50 listening audience. I have about 50% sex addicts. And I've got about 50% partners. Whether you be a partner that's a girlfriend, a boyfriend, a husband, or a wife, you know, oftentimes you're looking for the same types of advice as a sex addict. You know my spiel. The sex addict carries a shame. The partner carries the pain. And both can be very, very devastating. so many people ask me, Carol, is sexual addiction really a disorder, or is it an excuse for bad behavior? And tonight, I am so pleased to be talking with Todd Love, who, with four other international researchers, neuroscientists, they have done an entire literature study on the effects of sexual addiction. Now, I know you probably think that sounds intellectual, but I promise you this is going to be a fascinating show. The reason being that we know that sexual addiction is not just, it's not just an issue or disorder of willpower or of immorality. It is actually a disorder of the brain. And we've got neuroscience to back that up. And so Todd Love, as well as these four other internationally renowned neuroscientists and psychologists, did all the work for us and are going to be talking about what they looked at and what are the conclusions and why addiction, obviously in and of itself, is in our DSM-5, which is the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual that psychologists, psychiatrists, and psychotherapists go by. But why they really want people to understand how cybersex is truly crack cocaine of sex addiction, and sex addiction is truly a disorder. So we're going to be talking with him in just a few minutes about the evidence that he has come up with through a literature study. We need to do more research, so this is a really phenomenal research study. Can't wait to talk with him. And they're going to talk about how internet porn addiction can sometimes better conceptualize as a subtype of internet addiction, internet-related addiction, rather than a subtype of sex addiction. He'll be discussing the differences between internet porn addiction and sexual addiction, and the importance of a proper differential diagnosis as it leads to the application of appropriate treatment. And don't you want to know what is appropriate treatment? I mean, that's what this show is all about. You don't want to just put your life in the hands of anybody. I mean, I think counselors and psychotherapists, psychologists, and psychiatrists are doing the best they can, but very few know how to specifically treat sexual addiction, let alone internet addiction. And so we're going to find out more about that so that you can ask the right questions when you're dealing with the counselors that you're interviewing to see if they're really appropriate for you. Okay. Now, I want to talk to you about your life a little bit. You know, you may wonder, why is it so difficult for me to abstain from acting out, whether it be prostitution, voyeurism, exhibitionism? What makes this so difficult? Why don't I possess the discipline, the willpower to abstain? And from a neuroscience standpoint, you know, what we know is you have to practice healthy behaviors. And the minute you open up the door to an unhealthy behavior, you light up the reward center in the brain in such a way that you've now opened up the floodgates for lots of additional compulsive acting and compulsive thinking that can take you and drive you to behaviors that you've been abstaining from. I know in my group tonight, one of the members said, he was really new to the program, and he was in a 12-step meeting, and he said, you know what? I want to be just like everybody else, so I'm going to abstain from my voyeuristic and exhibitionistic tendencies, but I am going to look at Playboys, because all guys get to do that. That's normal. Now, what this guy has not been taught, he probably doesn't have a counselor who knows how that activates the brain. He cannot do that. That's the same mentality that I hear from men who say, oh, yeah, I'm abstaining from my deal-breaking behaviors, but I'm masturbating. Well, for 99.9% of the men that I know, and at least in early recovery and sometimes for the rest of their lives, they need to abstain from masturbation because ultimately they have linked masturbation to all the other images that they grew up with, starting at ages 6, 8, 10, 12. You know, when was the first time you saw a Playboy? When's the first time you saw a Hustler? From that point on, the brain linked these images, and if you have compulsive tendencies or if you were traumatized as a kid, what has happened is that these images became compulsive, and you spent a lot of time looking at more and more and more images and really training your brain in such a way that not just the images actually instigate the addiction, but maybe the sound of the computer as you turn it on, or the sound of ice in your drink because you always fixed a drink prior to looking at internet porn, or certain smells, certain tastes. So we got to really look at what connection do you have and how do you abstain from those connections. And unfortunately, that's why for many, many men and women, masturbation is absolutely a trigger. And now I know that that can feel very depressing if you think to yourself, oh my gosh, I'm never going to be able to masturbate again. That's not exactly what I'm saying. For some people it is. But for the majority of people, what I'm really saying is that for a period of at least 1 to 2 years, sometimes up to 3 to 5, you don't want to participate in any behaviors that's going to link you up to compulsively wanting to act out. Now, what do they say in the 12-step program? They say that you just take it one day at a time. Why? Because if you think about, oh my gosh, I'm not going to get to do this for a year, you can want to throw up your hands and say, I'm not doing that. So I would highly encourage you to use that one day at a time model, because any of us can do anything for a day, no matter what that is. And, you know, I just had a young woman today who's very, very depressed, and she's going to get put on some medicine, and she absolutely can't drink. And she said, you know, I'm not that big of a drinker, but the thought of not being able to have a glass of wine is incomprehensible. And she truly doesn't have a drinking problem, but it's that freedom that she lacks and misses. Well, that can be the same for sexual addiction. If you've linked up your addiction with alcohol, you may have to abstain from that. Well, I told her, you know what? I just want you to do that for a day. Anybody can do anything for one day. You do it for a day and see if you don't feel better. See if the medicine doesn't help your depression. And when you feel so much better with the depression, then you can go out and socialize with people. And when you socialize with people, you may have more energy and you can work out. And when you work out, you may actually have more energy for your job. And it should have a cascade effect. That's certainly what I see with my addicts who are in recovery. You know, doing one thing has a rippling effect so that then, you know, you may do other positive things that then makes you feel a lot better. I know one of the exercises I typically give men is to talk about, you know, I looked at internet porn because, and after they go around the circle and group, or they come back and they they come up with 10 reasons why they looked at internet porn, I ask them to then identify what's the emotional consequence of looking at internet porn. What did that do for you, to you? And usually they say things like, well, it made me feel shamed. I realized I had to tell my wife. I couldn't keep it a secret. It made me lose some valuable time at work. You know, it made me want to act out in different ways. It made me not like myself. It made me angry. It made me remorseful. I didn't want to have to come in and tell you, meaning me. So you can just see all of the damage that that can do when, in essence, somebody has just made the choice to violate his or her own boundaries and look at internet porn. And I got to tell you, when that happens, it can be devastating. So clearly, one thing that I know is that you really want to look at your behaviors. It really does matter what ends up happening. And as difficult as that can be, boy, the consequences are amazing when you have experienced, that positive feeling of all the wonderful things that occur when you followed your treatment plan and you're participating in your recovery tools. And you know the recovery tools. There are primarily 10 of them. And that may be attending 12 steps and talking to a sponsor and doing your 12-step work and seeing a certified sexual addictions therapist and going through group work and doing your journaling, your meditation, your prayer, your recovery reading, your SAA or SA reading, participating in healthy behaviors, maybe using some filters, you know, so that you don't have porn in the pocket. You know what those things can be. It may feel overwhelming if you think, oh my gosh, I have to participate in all of those recovery tools. Well, no, you don't. But what really is important is being able to utilize several of them, and that's what counts. And that's why you're listening to Sex Help with Carol the Coach, because I'm here to help you access what is it that you need to do to work on your sexual addiction. And tonight we are going to be discussing internet porn addiction and the neuroscience of internet pornography and why that may be considered an addiction. So, Todd, welcome to the show. The audience already knows that you've been doing this research study. Tell us a little bit about this study.
Hi. Okay. Essentially, this study is a literature review, analyzes hundreds of laboratory studies based in neuroscience. We came to the conclusion that there's overwhelming support for the concept that the neural processes at work in chemical addiction are fundamentally the same as those operating in the addictive use of the internet and its subtypes. The paper includes about 311 references to reviews the main scientifically accepted neuroscience theories or models of addiction based on substance abuse.
Okay, so you studied substance abuse and then primarily the literature review on neuroscience models and theories of addiction in general, correct?
Correct. Would you like me to go into the specifics for a minute on the
science
of addiction?
I sure would. Yeah.
Okay. So I looked at different angles. The neurobiology of addiction, there's two primary agencies that have propagated the resources, both NIH, the National Institute of Drug Abuse, and then the National Institute of Alcohol Abuse and Alcoholism. Anyway, so the first is the three-phase model of addiction. That comes from the NIDA. And basically, they define addiction as a process of change from impulsive to compulsive action with associated changing brain circuitry. So the key to the shift from impulsive to compulsive behaviors is a transition from positive reinforcement to negative reinforcement, which leads to the addictive cycle. And they talk about three stages of the addictive cycle: binge intoxication, withdrawal or negative affect, and preoccupation, anticipation. So,
can we break those down for a second? For instance, what is binge intoxication?
Okay, so binge intoxication, although different classes of drugs activate the reward center throughout different means, the universal result is a flood of dopamine in the reward center, the nucleus accumbens. So this results in acute positive reinforcement of whatever behavior that initiated the flood. So in the impulsive stage, the positive reinforcement results in addictive-related learning associations, and that's where neuroplastic changes begin to occur. However, it's the continued release of dopamine in the reward system that leads to an increase in other levels, in dynorphin levels. I'm getting more detailed than I need to. But the dynorphin decreases the dopaminergic function of the reward center, resulting in a decrease of the reward threshold, which leads to an increase in tolerance.
Okay, so you're not just talking about that high feeling, you're also talking about the chemicals that are produced in the brain, primarily dopamine, that one feels as they are binging on substance abuse or internet pornography, or both?
Both, yeah. So I'll get into the behaviors in a second, but the addictive behaviors activate this exact same circuitry. So, and I'll keep going through the three stages because it'll all come together. So in stage two, they call it the withdrawal or negative affect, and that's the dopamine flood in the brain is passed, and now there's an activation of the extended amygdala, which is an area associated with fear conditioning and pain processing. So the resulting negative emotional state leads to activation of the brain's stress systems and dysregulation of our anti-stress system. So this leads to a decrease in sensitivity to rewards and an increased threshold in the reward system. So basically, it gives negative reinforcement, encouraging the reinstatement of the addictive behavior. So,
okay, and the amygdala is where in the brain?
That would be midbrain, part of the limbic system.
Right. Because would you do me a favor and just for our audience, describe the three parts of the brain and how they interact, frontal lobe, obviously, the amygdala, and the back of the brain?
Okay. I am not a neuroscience, so neuroscientist.
I know
so
I know about it.
But I will present the way that I like hearing about it. They talk about, who was it, McClellan or somebody came up with the triune brain. So triune brain starts with the reptilian brain, and this is a non-anatomical, more of a conceptual, it's closely anatomical. But anyway, so the reptilian brain, and that's in the lower of the brain stem and the lower part of the brain, and that's pretty much everything living has that. So that's a reaction to stimulus, just kind of the physical nature. On top of that is the mammalian brain, and that brings in the limbic system. So we had, fear processing, love, excitement, emotion. So, and then on top of that is what they would call the neocortex, the human brain, I guess there's lots of different ways of wording that, and that's where we get the logic and reason. So the phenomenon, or I shouldn't avoid the word disease, I'm a big proponent of the disease model, the disease of addiction is where the midbrain, the limbic system, the mammalian brain is getting overactive and the frontal cortex is no longer able to kind of talk down to it and regulate whatever the behavior is.
Got it. So. Okay. So continue now. As you were talking, you were explaining a little bit about this study and what it looked at neuroscientifically. So I know
sure.
I interrupted and said, explain a little bit more about the brain and binge intoxication and the chemicals it produces, because, so many of our listeners feel like they lack willpower and feel like they're not disciplined, and they don't understand that this is really a neuroscience problem of the brain. You know, the brain is activated, and it's not just willpower. It's the chemicals that are produced in the brain.
That's exactly right. So the last stage in this three-part model, they call it preoccupation and anticipation, what we would call is craving. So the neuroplastic impairments, the changes that have gone on in the brain, it extends into other regions of the frontal cortex that's responsible for motivation, self-regulation, self-control, delayed reward discounting, and other cognitive and executive functions. So there's what they call an increased salience of learned addiction-related cues that came from the aforementioned positive and negative reinforcement of the addictive behavior. And at the same time, we have deficiencies in our top-down inhibitory control. Again, the top part of the brain is not able to, doesn't have the power anymore to talk to the into the limbic system, into the reward center that is basically in charge. So this leaves the individual vulnerable to reinstatement of the behavior. And they have found two primary mechanisms that really activate craving. They call it cue-induced reinstatement of the behaviors or stress-induced reinstatement of the behavior. I guess not of the behavior, but of the activation of that part of the brain. And there's multiple neuroimaging studies that support the model. And these impairments are one of the reasons that ASAM refers to addiction as a chronic relapsing disorder.
Absolutely, and explain what ASAM stands for.
No, okay. So ASAM is the American Society of Addiction Medicine. It's about 3,600 or so members, mostly medical doctors, addictionologists, neurologists, but also other clinicians. They released a medical definition of addiction in 2011, wherein they acknowledged that addiction involving food and sexual behaviors can be as real as addiction involving chemicals, and that they all involve pathological changes in the brain. So these changes in turn show up as pathological pursuit of reward and or relief with substance use or other behaviors, And that's kind of, those last three words were really big for us in our field, where they added and other behaviors, because it used to just be, you know, by relief with substances, but now they've acknowledged and other behaviors. So that brings in the concept of addictive behaviors. And then they
And it must be very frustrating for you when you're dealing with professionals and other people that don't believe that this internet addiction pornography really is an addiction or really does have addictive qualities.
Correct. So one thing I was went by earlier that I wanted to point out in the stage two part where we talk about withdrawal. So many people confuse detox with withdrawal. People will say, how could you be addicted to the internet or gambling? You know, you can't, you know, go into DTs from that. And what they're talking about is detox. So the body can acclimate to certain chemicals. And when we stop using them, then it can be, you know, in some cases, severe, life-threatening, you know, detox. But that's not withdrawal. During the addictive process, the reward center, basically, because we're bringing in exogenous chemicals or we're overactivating that part of our brain with our behaviors, the normal reward function kind of, I like to make a factory analogy. All the factory workers go home because we're taking care of it, you know, on our own. When we stop engaging in the addiction or bringing in the chemicals, nobody's running that factory anymore, so the reward center isn't working, so nothing is interesting. And that's what withdrawal is. It's an affective process. So, you know, and we've all seen it, you know, an addict gets sober, and the first thing, you know, for a while, they're restless, irritable, discontent, easily stressed, agitated. That's because the reward center in the brain hasn't reset itself yet, so just high strung.
Absolutely. So can I ask you, obviously, anybody who's listening to the show can tell that you have a lot of intellectual and academic background, what made you get involved in this study?
So this study was an extension of my dissertation. So I did my dissertation a few years ago, and it was right after the DSM-5 was released, which was kind of a debacle in my opinion, I guess in a lot of people's opinions. There was expectations and of what was going to happen, and it didn't. And I can talk in greater detail about that if you like. But the research I did for my dissertation, I pulled a lot of it out into here.
Right. Well, and you said I would love for you to be able to talk more about it. And let me just share with our listening audience, what Todd is referencing is that diagnostic and statistical manual that psychiatrists, psychologists, and psychotherapists use. And sexual addiction, as well as internet addiction, pornography, did not get into that manual. And Todd, you said that that was considered a debacle as far as you were concerned. And the reason you felt it was a debacle was because?
Sure. So my project was, it was an exhaustive review and analysis investigating whether or not internet addiction could have gone in the DSM-5. So it was proposed for the DSM-5. Pretty much everybody in the world thought that it was going to go in the DSM-5, even if it went into the appendix in the back as a condition for further study, meaning it's for research, it's not billable yet, it's still being acknowledged. And at the very last minute, without any public option for notice and comment and any of that stuff, the APA reworked it, and they released internet gaming disorder. So internet addiction was not acknowledged, and any of the potential subtypes of internet addiction, of which I hold that internet pornography addiction is a potential subtype of internet addiction, all those were kind of disavowed almost. So my research was to say, was this a valid decision? So I collected, I looked at, I think, 1,200 articles and books and book chapters and all that from around the world, and that's where I put together, I collected all the established theories on the neurobiological basis of the disease of addiction. Again, you know, where I was starting this with the neurobiology, the genetic studies, the molecular underpinnings, all of that, and so I kind of came to a foundational understanding of, okay, this is what the neuroscience expertise is saying is what the disease of addiction is when they're looking at substance abuse. Now let's see how much research has been done on the other or the next closest acknowledged, and it's now a fully acknowledged addiction, is gambling disorder. And sure enough, there was research out there, neuroscientific research on gambling that fits, a perfect overlay with the research on substance abuse. So I looked broader into other behavioral addictions, and internet addiction. It was the big one. And there are, there's over 120 brain studies at this point on internet addiction. Let's see here. The South Korean government called internet addiction a, quote, public health crisis about 5 years ago. You may have heard of the mandatory boot camps in China and South Korea, where they're putting these kids in as a digital detox because they're just, that's what they do. They're just, they're internet addicted. So the rest of the world has acknowledged that this is a problem, but it was not being acknowledged in the DSM-5. So I collected, I saw that there's, over 100 studies on internet addiction itself. Intermixed in there, there's studies on internet gaming disorder. So all the subjects were, their internet behavior was compulsive use of playing games or the addictive use of playing games. There was then a few studies on internet pornography addiction, but that all matched up with the internet addiction, the gaming and all that stuff. So I then went further into explanation or investigation of the DSM-5, and I'll talk about that in one second, But that last part of what I talked about is the core of what this paper is that we're talking about now, is that neuroscience literature review, and then the overlay of these are the findings for substance abuse, this is for gambling, this is for internet addiction and gaming. Wow, you know, if we look at the few studies on porn, there's not nearly as many studies on porn as there is on gaming or certainly gambling or, you know, alcoholism. But there's a few, and they're starting to come out, and the neuroscience is an overlay. So it's the same thing. They're finding the same brain areas light up, the same, you know, sensitization, desensitization, binging, withdrawal, all that kind of stuff.
Okay, and just, again, for our listening audience, would you talk about those categories? I mean, somebody may not know what desensitization means.
Okay, I had made a note on how I was going to explain that. Give me 1 second.
Absolutely, take your time. So I just feel for our listening audience that that's really important to understand, you know, the categories. And you said withdrawal, and you said desensitization occurs. And
so when we talk about neuroplasticity, that's kind of it's a big word, a buzzword these days. We're talking about the brain's ability to change and adapt as a result of experience. So it's kind of an umbrella term for forming new brain pathways. It's how we learn, and it's also how we become addicted. When you create and strengthen new pathways, that is learning, but that's also called sensitization. So, and then another form of neuroplasticity involves the weakening of old brain pathways, and that's an example of that is forgetting most everything you learned in school or breaking a bad habit. That's desensitization. So you take the two of those together, and they lump it, and they call it rewiring the brain. So when we're engaged in our addiction, we become sensitized to the importance, the salience, the reward of whatever it is our addiction, and we become desensitized to pretty much interest in everything else. That's a very broad statement, but
that makes sense. So that is one of the reasons that it is considered addictive, is because you lose your capacity to really be able to relate to other things because you're so hyper-focused on the addiction itself.
Correct. So here's something I found really interesting when I was doing this. Let me see here. I put in a layperson understanding for myself. So the more somebody is engaged in their addiction, the more the reward center is activated. And that's the mesolimbic dopamine pathway I was talked about before. There's a connection up to the frontal cortex, logic and reason. They call that the mesocortical pathway. So, you know, the whole sum is the mesocortical limbic. Anyway, that doesn't matter. The point is that the connection to the cortex is there to downregulate, say, okay, you've had enough, you know, you have to drive, or you're going to get in trouble if you do this, it's time to stop. Somebody who has just gone too far, that the mesolimbic part of the brain is lit up, and again, this is very rough analogies, I'm not speaking like a neuroscientist because I'm not, but it's lit up brighter than the pathway to the cortex. So basically, mm-hmm. the cortex mm-hmm. loses its ability to talk down and say, hey, we've had enough. And that is the neuroscientific basis of powerlessness. So, you know, AA figured
it
out. You know,
yes, absolutely. That powerlessness then is what then makes people feel like they have a compulsion that has taken hold of them.
Exactly. Yep. So I thought that
okay, continue.
Yeah, because, you know, the AA people figured out almost, you know, 100 years ago the concept of powerlessness, and anybody that works in addictions knows about the concept, but, you know, figuring out the science behind it, realizing that the pleasure part of my brain becomes stronger than the logic and reason at X point in time, you know, from a brain operations mm-hmm. perspective, that's when the tables turn, and I am now powerless to stop doing whatever it is that I'm going to do that is harmful for me. And it's because a shift in power and control in certain regions of the brain. So, it's a far cry from the old days of addiction being a moral failing and all this stuff. Now they're showing that, and this goes back to what you had asked about earlier, about the American Society for Addiction Medicine. That is why they came out in 2011 and came out with a formal medical definition of addiction because of these addiction-related brain changes. They're saying that this is an actual disease. You know, the addict hits a certain point, and the brain priorities shift. You know, the logic and reason is no longer in control. It's about the sensitization and the reward system and all of that.
How frustrating that our own the people that comprise the diagnostic statistical manual, they don't understand this, and yet other countries are saying it's the greatest epidemic ever. You know, why are we so behind?
Well, I recently found out that the World Health Organization, the new ICD, has also stepped away from the acknowledgement of internet addiction, you know, as a categorical term, so it's not going in there either. I don't know what has happened there. I'm speculating, or I've heard is political speculation as well. But we know it's a problem, and like I said, you know, certain governments have said this is a huge problem. But I'll talk to the DSM for a moment if you want. I've started to do that. I'm very ADD, by the way, so I like to jump around, so please feel free to redirect me as you need.
Absolutely, but continue. I definitely want to hear
okay.
more about this.
Okay, so the DSM-5, there were some proposed changes. There was to be an addiction and related disorders chapter. That's what they were going to rename the chapter to. And there's going to be a subchapter called behavioral addictions. Pathological gambling was going to move to the addiction and related disorders chapter. And then internet addiction and hypersexual disorder had both been proposed to be added, you know, if it's not to the full book, then to the appendix at the end for future research. What happened when it came out, the addiction chapter title was not created. Instead, they minimized the use of the word addiction. So they call it the substance-related and addictive disorders chapter. So pathological gambling was moved there. It was renamed as gambling disorder, but they didn't create the subchapter of behavioral addictions. Instead, they call it non-substance-related disorders. So now there's substance-related and non-substance-related disorders instead of addictions. Internet addiction was not included, and they put internet gaming disorder in Section 3, even though it was never proposed to be in there. They just created it. And then hypersexual disorder was not included. It was dropped at the very last minute. So there was some, I looked into what was the controversy around internet addiction. And one argument that I think is interesting is they talk about, you know, some of the opponents say addictions to the internet versus addictions on the internet. I call the delivery mechanism argument. Some people said alcoholics are not addicted to bottles and gamblers are not addicted to casinos, so how could someone be addicted to the internet? It's a delivery mechanism. And, you know, I get that. You know, I understand the logic. The easy response to that is just to have a mandatory subtype. So internet addiction, gaming type, internet addiction, pornography type. So then you're specifying what it is, not just the generic internet term. So that seems like an easy thing to have overcome. But anyway, so in my review of the DSM, I found a lot of inconsistencies. I mean, I went through in great detail all the supporting material, pretty much everything related in the book. And I found this interesting. In the 14 references in the internet gaming disorder chapter, 13 were to peer-reviewed academic journals. One was to a pop culture magazine, Wired. Of those 13 academic articles, only three were focused on internet gaming. Four talked about gaming as one of three subtypes of internet addiction. One referenced gaming as one of 10 subtypes of internet addiction. Three articles intermixed the words gaming, gambling, and pornography, and two just referred to internet use generally with no subtypes. So when I came to speculative conclusions as to, you know, what happened, my third conclusion, knocks them out of order, but I call it poor research logic and editing. And the poor logic example is basically they said internet addiction does not exist, but internet gaming disorder does. And here's 14 references to prove that, with only 3 of them supporting our conclusion and the rest, you know, are not. So basically A does not equal B, or B equals A. Does that make sense?
Why do you think that they saw gaming as different? I mean, what political reason is gaming different than internet addiction or pornography addiction?
And that's kind of my point. You know, that there, I don't think that there is one. I think a lot of people think that there is not one. So I'm an advocate for a concept of, you know, I like the term internet-related addictions. So it could be gaming, it could be pornography, social networking. So there's, I think somewhere in Scandinavia, there's a lot of research that's come out on Facebook addiction. They've had a Facebook addiction scale, and then several articles have come out validating the Facebook addiction scale, showing that it's accurately typing people who have, you know, just got compulsively pulled into that internet behavior. So whether it's gaming or it's looking at pornography or sitting there looking at Facebook for hours on end, if you are just addicted, you know, your brain, the reward area of your brain just gets lit up like fire when you are online and you let the rest of your life fall apart, you know, that's an addiction.
Oh, 100%. And, you know, it's interesting because was it, Al Cooper, who said, you know, cyber sex is the crack cocaine of sexual addiction. And you've heard that porn was referred to as the gateway drug for sex addiction. Now, these statements are horribly wrong when spoken as facts. So talk a little bit about that.
Okay. Yeah, let me get to that. So one of the impacts, or one of the questions people ask me about my paper is, you know, what are the implications of the concept of internet pornography addiction contrasted with sex addiction? And, you know, one implication of the findings is partially a challenge to the traditional assumptions regarding the relationship between porn and sex addiction. So the traditional conceptualization of cyber sex as, you know, the crack cocaine of sex addiction, like you said, or porn as a gateway drug for sex addiction, you know, aren't universally true as they used to be. And it's the concept I've not talked about yet, but I will do now. Again, this is my shifting gears, is supernormal stimulus. Do you mind if I talk about that briefly?
I would love that.
Okay. So Nobel laureate Nicholas Tinbergen came up with this term, I think, in the 50s or something. Anyway, in his experiments, he discovered that birds and butterflies and other animals could be duped into preferring fake eggs and mates. So he made these artificially sized and colored eggs, and he basically presented them to birds, and the birds would choose to try to incubate those at the expense of letting their real eggs, you know, wither. Butterflies, male butterflies, would try to mate with artificial plastic or cardboard or whatever, fake butterflies that had bigger, brighter, more colorful wings. So they talk about that being a supernormal stimulus. Deirdre Barrett, a few years ago, came out with a book where she uses that term, and also brings in, like, modern junk food is another example of supernormal stimulus. You know, the tongue, the body was meant to savor the sweetness of an apple, of a banana, not of high fructose corn syrup or whatever that is, you know, 10,000 times sweeter than what's in nature. The same thing with heavily salted and fatty foods, you know, McDonald's fries or whatever. You know, the body hasn't anticipated that, so it's literally a supernormal stimulus, and so, you know, it really activates the reward part of the brain. So engaging in excessive screen time, you know, gaming or whatever, that's just so activating. There's so much novelty and stimulation that you could call that a supernormal stimulus. And the same thing with pornography. You know, just so much, especially with people streaming the videos, and it's just so much content, so much, it's a super normal stimulus. So, you know, I would argue based on that, that hours at a time on games, hours at a time on pornography, those have more alike, or more like, you know, we call an internet-related addiction, than for a lot of people these days looking at pornography and the traditional sex addiction, other acting out behaviors of prostitutes or whatever. So porn and gaming goes hand in hand a lot more, you know, for somebody that I would call an internet porn addict than porn as a gateway drug that's going to lead them to prostitutes and affairs and all this stuff. That just, you know, for a lot, especially the younger generation that grew up with a computer, those other things don't happen. It's about being hooked on the screen.
Okay, so that is, again, an interesting study that helps to explain all this. Now, as we are beginning to wrap up, what would you like our listening audience to know about internet porn addiction? You know, do you consider it to be a sexual addiction? If so, why? And if not, why not?
I would say that the question, and you maybe intended it that way, is too black and white. So it's neither is correct, or they're both correct. So I think certainly for some people, we've all seen that porn is a manifestation of a sex addiction. I mean, I talked to somebody today, and he said, you know, if I'm not able to go out and find a prostitute, then I'm going to find some pornography. That's the traditional model of sex addiction, with porn being, you know, in that constellation of behaviors. But for other people, you know, it's not that. That's what they're doing is when they're acting out, you know, they're on the computer, on the screen. And the etiology is very relevant there. You know, the traditional model with sex addiction as an attachment disorder, as an intimacy disorder, you know, people will still cite very, you know, dated research talking about 97% of sex addicts have childhood emotional trauma, or 87% come from disengaged family systems. That just doesn't, you know, apply anymore when we're talking to the new generation of people that grew up with high-speed internet access, finding people have perfectly loving and attentive families, no history of trauma, and even the variable of the genetic predisposition of addiction isn't there anymore. It's just that growing up with this new novel stimulus of, you know, the pornography and the gaming, they're just constantly tied to the screen, just to the point where they edge the brain over into developing that disease of addiction, where that's how everything in life is mediated. You know, stress, anxiety, any type of negative emotion can be counterbalanced by activating the reward system and through looking at pornography.
Okay. And so clearly, I get that, you know, that wasn't black and white. I mean, there really are some differentiations. Ultimately, you're looking at the literature and studying that revealed what?
Can you ask that question a different way?
Yeah. Well, you know, here you did this literature research study. I mean, you looked at all the literature. I can't remember. What wasn't it? Something like 300 articles trying to determine, was IPA, internet porn addiction, was it conceptualized as a subtype of internet addiction? And if so, was it a subtype of sex addiction? And so I felt like your academic article, Neuroscience of Internet Pornography Addiction, A Review and Update, highlighted the flood of research showing that internet addiction did fall within the disease of addiction. There was no doubt about that. Do you agree?
Yes. Yep. And, you know, one of the ASAN people just released a book. He calls it Addiction is an Addiction is an Addiction. So it's all one disease. And he said there's a flood of research, 120-plus brain studies on internet addiction, and you know, different types, gaming, a few on porn. There's hundreds and hundreds of neuroscience studies on substance abuse, and they all line up. So I guess one key finding from this is some of the opponents of the model of pornography as addictive or pornography addiction say, oh, that's not an addiction, you know, there is no evidence supporting that, or there's, you know, so little evidence supporting that. However, in the legal world, you know, it's well recognized that lack of evidence is not evidence. And, you know, here there is emerging evidence, and the studies that have come out are, you know, a direct overlay. So just because there's not hundreds of studies yet doesn't mean that the few studies that are coming out are all showing exactly what you would expect them based on the addiction is an addiction is an addiction. So really the burden of proof shifts to those who want to claim that internet addiction subtypes are different, like the APA said. And that's what they said in the book, that internet addiction, you know, pornography and other internet behaviors are not considered analogous to internet gaming until further studies show that they are. And that was one of the conclusions of my dissertation, is that's just downright illogical. You know, the science doesn't make sense.
Absolutely. Well, and, you know, you are a techie from way back, and you've actually, I mean, you are just always doing something. Your ADHD has really helped you to make a difference in this world. You have actually come up with a porn blocker. Is that not correct? A personal porn blocker that you specifically developed it for the MacBook and the iPhone combination?
So it's not a program that I wrote, but rather it's an application. Well, actually, that has been wrong. So I have found through my own trial and error, because I was a techie, I was a corporate IT guy for 15 years. I had high-speed internet before it was publicly available, and I was working with IBM, had to private label it from AT&T, blah, blah, blah. So I've been struggling with this for a long time. And with my own ADD and impulse control proclivities, I could just get pulled into wasting my entire day of productivity online. So I have used for years all the different content filters, porn blockers, whatever you want to call them, for the web, and I've found ways to get around all of them. When I feel like being distracted and don't want to work, you know, over the years, I've never really been able to set up enough roadblocks to myself. So it's taken me years of iterative solutions, and I've finally found a way that I cannot, on my phone or on my computer, get access to blocked content. And so people have been asking me for years, document how you did that. So finally I did that. So it's a three-part blog post. Part one talks about how to lock down the Mac so that you can't get all the typical ways around the parental controls and all that stuff. And then part two is I recommend using the free program called K9, K and then 9.
Right.
And so it's how to configure that, what the best practice or the recommendations are for configuration settings. And then the third post is how to configure your iPhone or iPad or whatever and, you know, link them all together. So it's an end-to-end solution. You know, for me, it's all Apple-based, where I still have a smartphone, still have full access to computer. I can do all of my productivity and everything in life, but I really limit my ability to go and wander on the Internet.
Okay, now how can my listeners and clients find out more about this blocker?
It's on my blog. So my website is doctoddlove.com. So www.toddlove.com. And just go to my blog and I guess at the moment, it's my three most recent blog posts where I talked about, one, how to configure your Mac, two, to how to configure K9, and three, how to configure your iOS device. And I'll be doing a few more posts explaining some
blogs. Well, I appreciate that information, too, because let's face it, almost all my clients have filters and things on their phone, but mm-hmm. all of them know how to get around it, and it sounds like you have figured out a way to prevent that from happening. So for people that have a Mac, for people that have the iPhone, you've really found you said it wasn't software, but you found a formula that makes that very, very difficult, if not impossible.
Correct. I have not found a way around it.
So one more time for that listening audience. They may be getting a pen right now. And, of course, you can always get a hold of me, carolthecoach@AOL.com. But in the meantime, your website, they can go to your blog, and that is doctodlove.com. And they can find out more about this formula to keep you, keep your impulses down, because that's what this is all about. It is an impulse disorder in addition to all the other issues. So, Todd Love, I cannot thank you enough. If people want to get a hold of you, would it be fair to say that they can contact you at Todd, T-O-D-D, at ToddLovePsych.com?
I'm using the Doc Todd Love as now as my primary domain. So the same as the website. They could email me at todd@doctoddlove.com or
Got
go
it.
To the website, www.toddlove.com, and have all my info there.
Okay, so again, that's www.doctoddlove.com. What a great name for this business that you're in. You sound like a radio talk show host.
That's exactly what people have said. You know, they said, your name's not Dr. Love and you're a sex addiction therapist. You're just making that up to get clients. I'm like, no, really.
Great marketing, Todd. Well, thank you so much. You know, you've done such great work, and how exciting to have been in the presence of four other internationally renowned neuroscientists and psychologists. I mean, it had to be an amazing dissertation to work on, and I just thank you so much for your contribution to the field.
Thank you for having me on. This is very exciting.
All right. You take care, and we will talk. The more and more things that you develop and write about, I want to hear about them, okay?
That sounds great. Thank you for the support.
Okay. Have a great night.
Take care.
You are listening to Dr. Todd Love. He is a PhD, and, of course, he worked diligently at his dissertation to look at Internet porn addiction and was that part of sexual addiction. And I know, I mean, you could tell that's one bright man who really understands both addiction and brain neurocircuitry and plasticity. You know, Patrick Carnes told all of us that we were going to have to be neuroscientists in the next 10 to 20 years, and he is not kidding. You're going to have to be that too. But for right now, we're going to interpret that for you. Anyway, we are at the end of our show, and as I say to all of you every week, there will be only one of you at all times, so fearlessly have the courage to be yourself. Work your recovery tools. And we'll catch you back here next Monday night, 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, with more fascinating information about sex addiction and all of its subtypes. Have a great day.